Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 12, 2006. Our session today is entitled The Wealth and Mystery of Width. Our presenter is Fred Nieder. Session number NIF 2006-1. Let's listen in.
Thank you, John, and thank you, musicians. Welcome to Bible study. As I told you yesterday in orientation, my instructions are to keep this lively and not to put you to sleep. You've been working hard, and you have a new bite of food in your stomach, and that is a good combination for dozing off. I am used to this. I teach for a living. I love it, Christopher, so it's not work. Actually, I teach for free. They pay me to give grades. But I learned the first thing ever I learned as a teacher when I stepped before my first classroom was, oh my God, you can see everything. All those years that I was in school, I thought I was sleeping and no one would notice. My life passed before my eyes. But it may bother you more than it does me, therefore, if you should fall asleep. So I'm going to offer you a few tricks of things you can say when you find yourself having been caught dozing at a meeting or in some other event, or when your wife or husband or father or mother pokes you in the ribs when you've fallen asleep in church, as my mother used to do. You raise your head up and you say, oh, they told me at the blood bank this might happen. Or depending upon the circumstance, you raise your head and say, oh, you disturbed me just as I had the best way to put our new mission statement. But in this circle, of course, the easiest and best is simply to raise up and say, in Jesus' name, amen. This is Bible study, which means in several ways it's playtime. There's a new book out that I wish I'd written, or at least I wish I had thought of the title first. It's David James Duncan's new book, God Laughs and Plays. The Bible, our book, like our liturgy, remember, is habit forming. That is, it's habitat creating. It makes a home for us, a place for us to live in the world. It shapes us, and it shapes our world, and it invites us to come inside and to live. And so in our home we work, and in our home we play. So we're going to do some playing around in the scriptures. There's plenty of room for playing. The phrase with which we'll play is the theme verse for the summer, I am with you always. We know that phrase from the last chapter of Matthew's gospel. It's a part of what we call the Great Commission. We'll actually discuss it as a piece of Matthew on Thursday. It's part of Matthew's journey theology, and we're going to go some pretty wild places with Jesus in Matthew. We may think we know what Jesus means when he says or when he promises, I am with you always. The words are simple. I, that's Jesus. I am, which in Greek is ego eimi, which obviously immediately makes it much more complex. Nobody in the biblical tradition can hear that phrase without at least some echoes of last summer's theme up here at Holden, the burning bush story in Exodus. Who is this fellow who now goes around saying ego eimi, I am? Well, it's not so simple as it may look, and we'll have to play around with that eventually. And then there's with you. That seems simple enough, or the pronoun anyway is simple enough, as Paul Olson pointed out in the essay in the Holden newspaper. It's plural, and so in some parts of the country we would say yous, or yous guys. And we may assume that we know who that is, yous. But how well do you know this group, really, or any group? How well do you know your own family? Or even if it were singular, how well do you know yourself? Who are the yous to whom this promise is made? That's something else we'll play with. Play with. With, that's our other word. I am with you. And that seems simple enough. This promise of Jesus to be with us, and in this context at the end of Matthew, at this time in the life of the early church when not only the insiders but the outsiders were asking when any of them heard the Christians preach or say what they believed, namely that their Jesus, who'd been crucified, was risen from the dead, and some had even seen him. People said, okay, friends, if this Jesus of yours is risen from the dead, where is he? How can I see him? And what exactly is this Jesus doing? Each gospel has a way to answer that question, where is this Jesus? And we'll play with all those responses, but this promise in Matthew's gospel is the summary of Matthew's answer. This is not just any old I am with you, but ego eimi with you. And so it's really the answer to a much larger question. It's been asked a million ways, both within the habitat of our scriptures and elsewhere, and sometimes it's been asked playfully. Those of you who negotiated the road to adulthood with an assist from the old Saturday Night Live and its resident theologian, Father Guido Sarducci, you know that it was the great theological question in the theology component of his five-minute university. Where is God? God is everywhere. Why? Because he likes you. It was a combination of Disney and Catholic theology. But of course, the real and true and profound way to ask this question has rarely, if ever, been asked, better than the way Elie Wiesel asks it in his little Holocaust memoir, Night. Surely many, if not all of you, know that scene in which three prisoners are hanged while the entire population of the camp is forced to watch, and one of the condemned is a 13-year-old boy, too light for the noose to work quickly. So for many minutes, the other prisoners watch this youngster struggle between earth and sky, between heaven and earth, between life and death. And someone in the assembly breaks the terrible silence and asks, where is God now? And a voice inside Wiesel eventually answers, there is God, right there, hanging on those gallows. Our theme verse this summer is a response to that question too. And as we'll see, in terms of syllables and words, our answer is identical to Wiesel's, though we will load at least some different freight into those words. But we stand in the same crowd with Wiesel this week, and we ponder his question and our options for a response. But for the moment, I'm still not finished with. I am with you. Again, that may seem simple enough. It's what we say to our children when terrors strike at night. Not to worry, my child, I am with you. Nothing can happen to you so long as I am with you. But if you've ever learned another language besides your mother tongue, you know that the most mischievous pieces of any language are the prepositions. One of my college roommates wrote a whole dissertation on the nuances of the Latin in a collection of classic texts. Nowadays, that research that took him 2 years would take 6 seconds on a computer. I hope he's not crushed. It stands to reason that prepositions are so hard. They attempt to define location and to explain relationships. If you doubt the difficulty of these two subjects, remember God's first question in the Bible. It's, where are you? And the answer is, in the bushes. Where's that? And who are you to one another? I'm with him. I'm with her. Okay, what exactly does that mean? And by the way, Larry Huff and I did not plot to have preposition week. I don't think there will be of or with t-shirts for sale in the bookstore. Maybe there should be. For one thing, biblical Hebrew has at least three prepositions that mean with, be, eth, and im, and Koine Greek has several too, including sin and meta, the one that appears in our theme verse, meta, and each has a whole range of meanings. And we could play with any set of them for most of the day. With meta, for example, there's physics and then there's metaphysics. What does with mean there? Or we speak of simple change and then we speak of metamorphosis. But we're going to play with English for just a few minutes. The Oxford Dictionary lists 10 ways to use with. Webster's describes 12. We don't have time for anywhere near all of them. Actually, the first meaning of with is against. We compare this with that, which really means we set them up against each other and we compare the differences. Or we recall how Jacob was left alone and a man wrestled with him until daybreak. That's a very common relationship of with in the biblical tradition. Not only human beings love fighting and warfare, but we and God mostly fight. Is that what Jesus means? That we'll have it out in struggle till the ages of ages run out? Well, on the other hand, we say, whoever is not with me is against me. So it's the opposite of against. So it's no wonder it takes strangers to our language a while to learn our prepositions. Some will say they are ill with cancer, and others will say they're struggling against cancer. Is there a difference? With is a word of accompaniment, which is how we usually take it in our theme verse. Come with me and be my love, we say when we finally work up the nerve. And this could be Jesus' meaning. Nothing can separate us, for we have vowed faithfulness this day. Something close to this is the way Moses used to talk with God face to face, the way a man talks with his friend, says Exodus 33. And then again, we not only fall in love with people, we also get angry with them. And then sometimes you can't tell companionship from enmity, but both are with the same person. And how like that is our relationship with God. As Reuel Howe wrote long ago in a book all seminarians once upon a time had to read, which is why, because of its age, it has these non-inclusive pronouns, God knows we both love and hate him, but God can take it. We use with also in an instrumental way. Colonel Mustard did it in the ballroom with a candlestick. Or do it with all your might. Given what Jesus wanted to accomplish by means of this little band he sent on a mission of discipling, this would be a sensible reading of with at this point. Even for I am to say, I am who I am with in this, or excuse me, I am who I am in this world with you, means I do it by means of you. And this would fit God's modus operandi in the Bible. Remember how God told Moses back in the book of Exodus in the days of Pharaoh's hard-heartedness, see, I make you like God before Pharaoh, and Aaron shall be your prophet. The closest Pharaoh would ever get to seeing God was looking on the face of his one-time palace mate, Moses. And the closest some may ever come to seeing God is the sight of you in some moment when your presence changes everything. I am with you. We speak of those who are with it and those who aren't. We talk about going with the flow. My favorite use of with is still the one from childhood, the one I learned in Luke's nativity story that so many of us memorized in the old King James. Joseph also went up from Galilee to be taxed with Mary, his espoused wife, being great with child. It's silly, obviously, to imagine Jesus thinking somehow that he's pregnant with disciples. But there was something aborning in the moment that this theme verse describes. And the plot thickens when we ponder the word order in which Matthew gives us these words of our theme. It does not read, ego, a me, meth, himon, I am with you, but it reads, ego, meth, himon, a me. The with you is in the middle between the parts of I am. I with you am. Sounds like pregnancy to me. The great I am is mother to us all, and always aborning we are. Ever children, always growing, starting over and over. And even when this mother takes us to the city gates for the ultimate discipline, as happens in that curious poem in Hosea chapter 11, the end of which could mean that stones will fly and the rebellious child must die, this mother remains with us, not a mortal, but the Holy One in our midst. From her womb we come, and in her arms we die. I, with you, am to the close of the age. Few stories in the Bible probe the mystery of withness like the stories that begin with the golden calf episode in Exodus chapter 32. It's the absence of God's agent Moses, who was not only like God to Pharaoh, but also to the band of escaped slaves. That absence leads the people to construct for themselves cherubim, ancient symbols of God's presence, to go with them through the wilderness, they say, to the promised land. And the story turns out badly. And the reasons are mysterious, and they take plenty of study, and we don't have time. Old fights among the people in the generation that recorded that older story got played out. And so the chapter reminds us that the real issue remains the way that we know or don't know whether God will remain with us on our journey. Once it had seemed clear, or so we think, Moses and God used to talk together the way a man talks to his friend, panim el panim. And if you've been to the Middle East and talked with people there, you know panim el panim. You do talk face to face. But now things have changed. In the difficult days after the golden calf episode, when God swore nevermore to go up with the people, but would send a messenger instead, lest in a fit of anger at yet another episode of murmuring and rebellion, God totally nuked those people. So Moses asked God for a favor. "Show me your face," he said. "Let me know your secrets." And the secret he really wanted to know, of course, is whether his people would make it to the promised land, the goal of the journey. How will this come out? God says, "I'll tell you my name. I'll even exegete my reputation." Moses says, "No, I want to see your face. It's the only way I'll know you are with us." God says, "Sorry, impossible. No human sees the face of God and lives. But sit here in this crevice, and I'll put my hand over your eyes as you pass by, as I pass by. And as soon as I'm past, I'll remove my hand, and you can see my acharei in Hebrew, backside." And what, pray tell, is the derriere divine? How can you tell the front from the rear of God? Well, to be out front of God, of course, is to live in the future, and we never get to do that. Not until somehow we might cross some boundary, not only of space but time, could we do that. And so all we can do is live in the wake of where God has been, looking at the signs in what we call history. Signs that God is gracious and merciful, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love, and repents of the evil that God has threatened. We call that work theology, but it's also how we do history. We search for patterns, for footprints of God's presence or absence. Most of you know that picture and poem about the footprints in the sand. I'm always amused as a teacher how every generation believes it's the first to have discovered this thing. But I want to offer you an alternative for the picture of the footprints in the sand. It's something that comes from the territory of my earliest childhood in open range country in Wyoming. And I never did this myself, but I'm told that this is a tactic of some of the ranchers at roundup time to get a particularly recalcitrant steer in off the open range, lest it die from the elements. Now they can use helicopters. Back then, they took a donkey from the home place out to where the steer stubbornly stayed. And in addition to the donkey, they took a stretch of rope with a harness on either end. And they put one harness on the donkey and the other harness on the steer. And then they went home. The secret of that tactic is that a donkey will go to where it's been fed. Period. It will make it. So they would harness these two animals to each other and go home, knowing that in about 3 days, here the two would come, both of them a bit bloodied, but both of them home. That's my picture of the footprints in the sand. If you knew the story of my life, it would not be two sets, and then one set, and then two sets. It would be the faithful set of donkey tracks and a whole lot of skid marks. That's what we're going to do this week. Look for donkey tracks and skid marks, signs that God is with us. And from those signs, renew our resolve to go out with good courage.